ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Populist leaders, those who claim to listen to the masses and rail against the prevailing elite, they're on the rise. And populism has certainly always been at the heart of American politics and a driver for voices of dissent in that country. But now, under Trump, is something very different. Natasha Mitchell with a Big Ideas episode today, making sense of populist rage in the USA.
The interesting thing is not that populism is so powerful in America. What's different is that populism won in America. Normally, the role of the two-party system is to absorb change, to bring the populist in. What's unique about right now is the populist absorb the party.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jefferson Cowie is a professor in American history at Vanderbilt University. He's going to help us explore the roots of populism in the USA, the way it has played out under different presidents, and how the current resurgence is radically transforming the American political landscape. And fast. Let's head to Berlin and the American Academy there, where Jefferson Cowie is one of this year's Axel Springer Fellows.
Angry white guys are kind of my business. Business is booming. So I want to start out with a kind of a simple truth. For me, it's pretty obvious, but I think a lot of us, especially those on the contemporary center and left, have forgotten. And that is about 3/5, maybe 2/3 of Americans are wage earners without a college degree. And let's, for argument's sake, call this vast mosaic of races and genders and peoples the American working class. And I want to tell you that this group has received a really raw deal in the last two generations. Wages have stagnated for decades. Prices of goods have gone up. They were driven out of collective bargaining agreements by corporate elites and anti-labor politics of the 1980s. Their jobs were sent elsewhere by trade deals that ignored their interests. They were written off by economic policymakers. They were sent to war under false pretenses. They watched their towns get hollowed out and the life expectancy of their loved ones decrease. They were condescended to by the political pieties of a Brahmin left that had better things to worry about than the material well-being of common people. They also incurred the anxieties directly correlated with dramatic increases in economic inequality, increases in drug addiction, homicide rates, teen pregnancy, erosion of trust, drug abuse, incarceration, and violence of way too many forms. And then a surprising thing happened. Somebody came around and said the quiet part out loud. The system is rigged. And that made a lot of sense to a lot of people. Nobody else was saying it. Everyone else seemed to be engaged in bipartisan warfare over the best way to prop up that very same rigged system. Building from a white southern base, the idea that the system was rigged allowed the blue wall of the former industrial Midwest to fall to the MAGA movement in 2016. And despite losing the popular vote by almost 3 million, the rural-centric Electoral College went down in one of the biggest upsets in American political history. Democrats hobbled forth with what pundits called their U-shaped coalition, consisting of college-educated elites on one end and the multicultural poor on the other. The great vast middle, the former core of the party, had long fled. And what I want to talk about is that great unwashed middle. Little background. The way I see politics is it doesn't work in simple partisan cycles. It works in eras. It works in ages. Narrow partisanship dukes it out within those eras. So, for instance, Dwight Eisenhower was working within Roosevelt's New Deal. Bill Clinton was working within Reagan's neoliberal paradigm. Every 40 or 50 years, we find ourselves in a sort of coalitional reshuffling in which both parties have to function. As the German-American political scientist Jaska Munk put it, there are long decades in which history seems to slow to a crawl. Elections are won and lost, laws adopted and repealed, new stars born, and legends carried to their graves. But for all the ordinary business of time passing, the lodestars of culture, society, and politics remain the same. Then there are those short years in which everything changes all at once. Political newcomers storm the state. Voters clamor for policies that were unthinkable until yesterday. Social tensions that had long simmered under the surface erupt in terrifying explosions. A system of government that seemed immutable looks like it might come apart. And this is the moment in which we find ourselves today in the United States. The stakes are much higher than how Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton might have won, what micro policy move might have saved the day, whether Joe Biden screwed it up altogether. Those people were all in the last paradigm, not the new one. This kind of reshuffling happened in the 1830s. It happened in the 1890s. It happened in the 1930s. It happened in the 1970s, and it's happening now. And in each era, populism played an important role in the remixing. The end of an era becomes a contest, as Gramsci famously wrote in from his Italian prison cell, in which the old is dying and the new has yet to be born. And in the midst of that transition, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Right now, we are having difficulty differentiating between morbid symptoms and enduring political realities. And it will be that way for years to come, I think. And I used to think that the current period of political reshuffling was anybody's game. I no longer do. The center-left has failed to come up with a fresh project. The right has come up with a backward-looking project that nonetheless is shaping the paradigm of the future. There's still a chance that we may come up with a new competing model, one that might be imagined fresh. But as of now, it seems the die is cast and liberals are playing on terms defined by their enemies. And whatever happens, whatever's already happened, it will be defined by the most enduring political paradigm in American history, populism. Populism, in its most concrete form in America, was a progressive farm labor movement of the 1880s and 1890s. Formerly known as the People's Party of the 1890s, later co-opted by William Jennings Bryan in the Democratic fusion of the election of 1896, the populace came up with all sorts of crazy ideas like progressive income tax, government regulation of industry, currency reform, eight-hour day laws, national control of railroads, banking reform, prison reform. And they essentially, these farmers stood astride the Gilded Age and said, stop, something's gone wrong. The birthright of America, the Jeffersonian promise of the smallholder republic had gone sideways. You may know William Jennings Bryan from a couple of things. Most famously is his Cross of Gold speech in Chicago in 1896 when he said, "You shall not crucify mankind on a cross of gold," specifically thinking it was a statement about currency. Or if you're a Wizard of Oz fan, you may know him as the Cowardly Lion. The Wizard of Oz is a populist parable. The shoes weren't ruby, they were silver, which was about an inflationary monetary source. So the spirit of populism existed most profoundly in the capital P populist moment of the 1890s. But it also existed avant la lettre and après la lettre, is that how you say that? In, I think, one of the most enduring forms and one of the most important forms of American political expression from the so-called people. Go back to me for a second to 1830. We have Andrew Jackson's famous bank veto, when he vetoes the Bank of the United States. And this is populism. This is the people. This is a person coming in, speaking on behalf of some version of the people against the contagion that has stolen the birthright of the Republic. Jackson is a rather spectacular version of this. He is also a rich man, a slaveholder, but is seen as the restorer of the Jeffersonian tradition. And his role in this is sort of fascinating and also resonates with today, in that the fact that he destroyed the Bank of the United States, which was seen as an aristocratic intrusion into the lives of the common people, ended up in the Panic of 1837 and the destruction of the American economy. His critics saw Jackson as a monarch, taking over the republic, restoring a monarchy, ignoring rules, wiping his feet on the Constitution, and essentially ignoring the traditions of the democratic governance. Again, something that might resonate again with today. So we see this time and time again in the United States. So what is this thing, populism? And why is so many angry people get drawn to it? Well, it's more than a kind of left-leaning reform movement. It's more than a right-leaning reform movement. It is the dominant vocabulary of dissent in the United States, and now maybe globally. We can talk about the global dimensions. The historian Michael Kazin gives us a reasonable definition, I think. Populism, he says, is a language whose speakers conceive of ordinary people as a noble assemblage, not bounded by class, who view their elite opponents as self-serving and undemocratic, and seek to mobilize the former against the latter. It's a mood, and it's a mode, and it's a language. Now, the Populist Party had a program, and it was an excellent program, but by and large, the way this works through American history, it is more of a approach, more of a sort of grammar of dissent that can go multiple ways. So what are the elements in this? First, it's always the people versus the interests, not the workers versus the bosses, the people, however they are conceived, against some other outside influence. Oftentimes the people can be exclusionary. It's often white, native-born men. Not always, but often. And it's sometimes in league with sort of middling sorts of other types of folks. It's not a clean class division by any stretch of the imagination. And the interest, too, could be anything. It could be the Hollywood elite in our own time. It could be the bankers. It could be the railroads. It could be Jews. It could be black people. It could be immigrants. Embedded in populism is this fear of decline, this constant churn going on and on about the fact that everything's about to collapse. And if it's an emergency, and if something doesn't happen, we are going to fall from first principles. Sometimes you're looking back to the American Revolution, like the Jacksonians, a lost golden age, like the Depression-era populace of Father Coughlin, or in the case of Alabama Governor George Wallace, the glory days before the federal government came in and told you how to behave around black people. It's often nationalist or at least patriotic, sometimes a civic patriotism, sometimes kind of a dark patriotism. And that can cut multiple ways, and it can cut multiple ways with sometimes the same people, like Coughlin, who is on the left, on the right, but always using the same language, the same kind of us versus them, inside or outside, restore the old order kind of approach. The urgency is palpable in these guys, and they're mostly guys. There's a few women. The emergency is now. A lot is at stake. And this is really central to the populist impulse because, and they always need to find another urgent issue to keep the churn turning. Regionally, it tends to be like the capital P populace, tends to be Southern and Western. And we see that today as well. But going all the way back to Jackson, who was the first sort of frontier president, the first one to be out, you know, not part of the Eastern Seaboard elite, you know, even though he was rich and a slaveholder, he was Old Hickory, the man of the people. And we're going to talk more about the regional politics in a bit. It challenges the two-party system. Populism can't be contained within the existing two-party paradigm. They're both corrupt. They both need to be overthrown. There's some sort of virus in the body politic that can't be sustained. And so they tend to be third parties, insurgents, challengers. And the interesting thing is not that populism is so powerful in America. What's different is that populism won in America. Normally, the role of the two-party system is to absorb change, to bring the populist in. What's unique about right now is the populist absorbed the party. If we go back to this two-party thing, we see that the Jacksonian impulse is brought into Van Buren's democratic machinery. The populist party is brought into the middle-class progressive movement of the 20th century. Franklin Roosevelt was a master at manipulating several populists in the 1930s. We don't think about this enough. We just think the Depression happened and the New Deal happened. But he was actually manipulating on a regular basis the populist persuasion within his project. Come to the creation of the last paradigm from the 1970s and 1980s, we see Nixon and then Reagan effectively co-opting the Southern populists, especially George Wallace, Strom Thurmond, folks like that, segregationist populists. So then it's idealistic, it's evangelical, and tends to be a little simplistic sometimes. The actual capital P populace were quite smart, quite well-read, a lot of lecturing, but in general, it tends towards rather simplistic answers backed up by a sort of evangelical energy. And finally, the final element is they're almost always using new media. For Jackson, it was the penny press, this new thing where you could buy a newspaper for a penny. And these were deeply partisan newspapers. For the capital P populace, it was the railroad. You can get on the back of a train, go give a talk somewhere, be in the next town for another talk the next day. For the 1930s, it was the radio, on and on. Television, post-fairness doctrine, shock jock radio, and then something that non-historians call the internet. But this new media allows the voice to project higher, bigger, stronger. The message sounds more virulent because it is now coming in through this new system. And it has a particular power.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Jefferson Cowie picking apart the history of American populism today here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Now, two factors in populism, labour movements and social class. Let's find out why Jefferson thinks they're important.
So I want to talk about something central to populism. And apparently there's fancy words for this, but there's an absence here. And the absence is this sort of idea of class. What's going on here? Well, there's a problem. There's a problem at the center of American history. And that problem was posed by a German sociologist, a guy named Werner Sombart. And this guy wrote a famous essay and book called Why Is There No Socialism in America? And his question really wasn't why is there no socialism in America, because this was happened to be at the apex of socialism in America. But what he's saying is why, relative to other advanced industrial nations, not a phrase they used then, but were class movements weak in America? And there are endless theories about this. And, you know, if you ever want to start a fight at a labor history conference, just throw out a theory about why class relations in America are different, and you're in for, you know, several beers. There's fragmentation thesis about that essentially class is an internecine war over ethnicity and region and all these other issues and race. slavery and whiteness, that as Du Bois said, there's a psychological wage to being white, so you are not going to make solidarity with black people. Western expansion, as Franklin put it, is a safety valve. One of Sombart's answers was capitalism works really well in America. On the shoals of roast beef and apple pie, all socialist utopias are sent to their doom. It's good stuff. America already had a revolution. We don't need another one. It's about getting back to the one we already had. Louis Hartz, in the middle of the 20th century, put forth a famous argument. There's no feudalism in America, therefore no socialism. Class relations emerged out of feudalism. Another argument, individualism and mobility prevented class. And it really doesn't matter. I don't care which one of these things you believe, but you have to, in order to proceed my argument, you have to believe that something's going on here. And some people regrettably call this American exceptionalism. I prefer the idea of an outlier nation, that on the edge of a spectrum of nations, the American experience is sort of on the edge. So what does this mean for our topic today? It does not mean that class-based movements are not weak because of populism. Populism isn't causing the problem. Populism is strong in places where class-based movements are weak. It's filling a void. And even in modern day class or right-wing populists today, essentially it is based on the eradication of a labor movement or an independent voice for working people. Borrowing from other scholars of populism, I also want to put this final element out there, and that is that there's a left and a right version of this. The diet of populism of the left looks at the people fighting the interests. The enemy is usually an economic elite. Or there's a triad of populism that has an enemy below as well as enemy above. And the enemy below is often immigrants, people of color, occasionally women, other sorts of things. What's interesting about this is that any given populist figure can flip switches, codes, as the kids say. And so Mary Elizabeth Lease, queen of the populace from Kansas, and Tom Watson from the Deep South from Georgia, did just exactly this. Mary Elizabeth Lease less than Tom Watson, but both were militant populists. Mary Elizabeth was famous for saying Kansas needs to raise less corn and more hell. And Tom Watson was one of the most noted agrarian rebels in the populist movement. Tom Watson started out making an alliance with black populists before basically turning to the arguing that black people were the problem, championing lynching of black people and other heinous acts. And Mary Elizabeth Lease, who more or less did a better job of keeping her politics glued together, but eventually started blaming Asians, Jews, and others late in life for the fate of America. But the idea is, these are not clean lines. Populist doesn't have a particularly right-left split. Okay, my favorite populist. My last book was about the county that George Wallace came from. And I want to use George Wallace as an example to sort of explain how all of this gets operationalized, usually, within the two-party system. Wallace is one of those chameleon populists, but is really known as a hardcore segregationist. He started out as a New Deal kind of reformer, found out the power of race when he was beat by an ardent segregationist for the governor's office of Alabama, and then went hardcore segregation and became known as Alabama's fighting judge because he refused to give voting records to these federal judges. These Justice Department. He ran against the federal government, against integration, and is most famous for the words segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, which is in like every textbook in America. And so he's on his way. He ends up running for the presidency in 64, 68, 72, and 76. As a Democrat in all of those races, except 68, he runs as an independent. And that's when he really gives everybody a run for their money. And also because everybody was so freaked out by that race, which was quite close, actually, between Nixon and Humphrey, that we came very, very close to doing away with the Electoral College. As close as we have ever come under Birch Bayh's leadership. So he subverts the two-party system. He comes from the outside. His phrase is stand up for America. He's the guy who's going to save you from the federal government that's going to mess with your life. And then Kevin Phillips, who is Nixon's one of Nixon's key strategists before he became an author and pundit, said that, you know what, George Wallace is the future. That populist incursion we're seeing boiling up in the Deep South is actually the story of the Southern voters moving from a Democratic past to a Republican future. And so Nixon totally gloms onto this, and he watches everything. Nixon is notorious for ignoring domestic policy. He really wanted to, you know, deal with foreign policy. But his orders to his two leading advisors were, anything that has to do with Wallace, send my way. And he becomes a student of Wallace. And he actually, it seems, probably bribed his way to make sure that Wallace ran as a Democrat in 72 rather than as an independent, because as independent, he would rob from both parties. As a Democrat, he would destroy the Democrats. And so he becomes kind of a talisman of the future, if you will. And this is about the fundamental shift in recent American history in which the South moves from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, largely after the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965. The New York Times said that Ronald Reagan, and I quote, sailed into the White House on the tide George Wallace discovered. Wallace was seen as, quote, too unsettling, too vulgar, and too overly Southern to win. But Reagan was not. Later in life, Wallace said, they all talking like me. Nixon, Reagan, Clinton, welfare reform, crime, big government. They all saying now what I was saying then. I wish I'd copyrighted my speeches. So this is the kind of the classic formula of how the body blows of populism are absorbed into the two-party system. And that's the typical route. And now we're on the edge of a new paradigm, right? The old one breaks down in the 70s. The new one begins in the 1980s. That's the paradigm that just is in the process of breaking down today, what most people would call neoliberal paradigm. And this is partially what I call the triple movement of the 70s and 1980s. One is the decline of unions, the attack on unions, the sort of end of the institutional representation of workers, both politically and economically. The rise of what some would call identity politics, but a kind of a post-material politics, a politics that tends to politicize everything except the market. And the third is automation, the rise of the service sector, and global outsourcing. And as the political theorist Wendy Brown put it, when class is disavowed as a political subject, the tensions of inequality do not disappear. Other markers of social difference may come to bear an inordinate weight. Indeed, they may bear all the weight of the sufferings produced by capitalism, in addition to that attributable to the explicitly politicized marking. So we have a hole in civic life. What? You're on the edge of your seat, could fill that hole. But I have one more variable to quickly explain. And that is the fact that we now live in a deeply polarized political space, right? Some of you may know this idea from Ezra Klein's book, Why We're Polarized. But essentially in the post-war era, from the 30s all the way up until really the 80s, the political system in America was not two parties. It was four. It was liberal Democrats, conservative Republicans, and something that used to be called a liberal Republican. Liberal Democrats were Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Jack Kennedy, George McGovern, et cetera, et cetera. Conservative Democrats were the southern wing of the Democratic Party. Conservative Republicans were Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater. People wanted to roll back the New Deal. Liberal Republicans were Nelson Rockefeller, Jacob Javits, New York Republicans, or even maybe Richard Nixon, Eisenhower, people who wanted to make their peace with the New Deal, not destroy it. Well, with the types of things that we just saw with George Wallace, we're beginning to see a shift of the Deep South and then the entire South to the Republican Party. And so the Liberal Democrats and the Liberal Republicans, kind of, you know, go the way of the dodo bird, become one party. And the conservative Republicans and the conservative Democrats become one party. And then we have a two-party system. And what does that mean? What that means is, to get something done, you had to compromise. It was a semi-quasi-parliamentary system in which you had to make a deal with either inside the party or across party lines. Now, political entrepreneurial activity means moving apart, distinguishing. All elements must go into separating the institutions until we have the situation we have today. Polarization. Which brings us to the 1990s. 1990s, the most famous quote, 1989, close enough, we're in the ballpark. Francis Fukuyama, his famous end of history essay, as the Berlin Wall falls, he writes, "What we may be witnessing is not just the end of the Cold War, but the end of history as such. That is the end point to man's ideological evolution and the universalism of Western liberal democracy." Or maybe it's Pat Buchanan. Maybe it's the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke. Maybe it's Ross Perot of the Reform Party. Maybe it's Newt Gingrich driving that polarization on a daily basis, right? What we forget about is this other 90s, the non-Clinton 90s. It's not about NAFTA and the, well, it is about NAFTA and the WTO, but it's like anti-NAFTA and WTO. It's not just about tech and downloading all the albums you can off the internet and all sorts of exciting new things. It's about a deep, profound populist backlash against everything that's going on. I give a lot of talks in the Midwest, and there's one word that will get working people in the Midwest spitting nails, and that word is Clinton. Because of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the most, like, ill-conceived political concept ever generated, because it actually, the amount it generated in trade was negligible. The amount of cost it incurred upon the Democratic Party was almost infinite. And these guys knew it. Pat Buchanan, 1987, shocking, almost irrelevant statement at that time that now seems prophetic. "The greatest vacuum in American politics is to the right of Ronald Reagan." Nobody believed there could be anything to the right of Ronald Reagan in 1987. 1998, Richard Rorty wrote Achieving Our Country, and this is a very long quote, and I apologize for this, so I'm going to read it fast. "Members of labor unions and unorganized, unskilled workers will sooner or later realize that their government is not even trying to prevent wages from sinking or to prevent jobs from being exported. Around the same time, they'll realize that suburban white-collar workers themselves, desperately afraid of being downsized, are not going to let themselves be taxed to provide social benefits for anyone else. At that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for. Someone willing to assure them that once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen, and postmodern professors will no longer be calling the shots. One thing that is very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black and brown Americans and by homosexuals will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet." That's, you know, 18 years before Trump. We've spent a lot of time saying, "Oh my God, have you seen what Trump did? What's going on?" I want to talk a little bit about what the liberals did not do. And there's a lot on that list. But I think the main thing they did not do is defend fundamental institutional liberalism. I'm not even talking about ambitious plans for healthcare or public transportation or infrastructure. I'm talking about defending the right to vote. The commemorative for the passage of the 15th Amendment, providing a very, very, very weak right to vote for African Americans during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. And this was a moment, Eric Foner, the great historian, calls it the second founding. You could call it the second republic if you wanted. And it never lived up to its promise, but its promise was great. And its potential energy was great. And what happened was what white people in the South called the redemption. That is, they redeemed political power from black people. And what we've seen in the United States, I would argue, is since the Civil Rights era, Voting Rights Act of 1964 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is a long, slow, grinding redemption of white power against black people and all people in some ways. So I've heard a number of people describe what's going on today as a crisis of democracy, a subversion of democratic norms and traditions. Most recently, somebody said it was an upending of the laws of democratic physics. I think it's an absolute affirmation of the laws of democratic physics as practiced in the United States. Consider that the majority of American voters, despite a deeply flawed system, selected a Democrat for the White House every single election cycle from 1992 until 2024, except for 2004, 1 year. And the will of the majority was not listened to. And it came to a head in Bush v. Gore. Maybe you remember those long, long nights of waiting for those vote returns to come in. And ever since then, I've been asking my students one question. How do you know you have the right to vote? And they look at me and they're like, Voting Rights Act? I'm like, no. 15th Amendment? No. 19th Amendment? No. The Constitution? No. The right to vote is established on the state level. It is a state function, which means it is captured by this very same interests that ought not be captured. So it's a profound form of regulatory capture, if you will, in which the political elites of a state run the vote counts, which makes it ripe for corruption of various kinds. And the Supreme Court affirmed this in Bush v. Gore in 2000 with the following. The individual citizen has no federal constitutional right to vote for electors for the president of the United States, unless and until the state legislatures choose a statewide election as the means to implement its power to appoint members of the Electoral College. So if they decide to run an election, then we will abide by it. So within all of the anger, all of the backlash, there's actually some hope here just through a vigorous enforcement of fundamental liberal institutions. That has not happened. There were movements to make a constitutional amendment for an affirmative right to vote after Bush v. Gore. There were a variety of reforms. I'm in favor of a constitutional amendment, affirmative right to vote. Not an easy project, I know. But they all were swept away by 9/11 and then the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Ben Rhodes, President Obama's deputy national security advisor, released his memoir a number of years ago. And it opens with him and the president riding along in a motorcade in Lima, Peru, shortly after Trump's first election. Obama was struggling to understand Trump's victory. What went wrong, he said. He had just read a column arguing that liberals had failed to recognize how important identity was to people and how empty and left behind cosmopolitan globalism made voters feel. Maybe we pushed too far, he said. Maybe people just want to fall back on their tribe. Those comments from the end of his second term bookended a very controversial, but perhaps infamous, thoughts he had made just a few years earlier during his campaign for the White House. These are comments he ended up having to apologize for publicly. You go into these small towns in Pennsylvania, and like a lot of small towns in the Midwest, jobs have gone. Now for 25 years, and nothing's replaced them. And they fell through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and each successive administration has said somehow these communities are going to regenerate, and they have not. And it's not surprising that they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy toward people who aren't like them, or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. Obama had put his finger right on the problem, intuitively recognized it. In a dizzying world of global trade, immigration, technological disruption, people sought grounding in place and time. So what I want you to take home with you is that populism is a constant in American history. How it is expressed is a variable. We will continue to see it. And however the paradigm reveals itself in the coming years, I promise you this is going to be part of it. The odd thing, though, is what Gramsci called the morbid symptoms, I believe, have become self-aware. What do I mean by that? I mean the media, of course, the internet, AI-generated thinking, but also the fact that somebody like Steve Bannon actually went around looking consciously for a populist to drive the project. Most of these populists emerge from the hinterland and do their job. Bannon was like, that's the guy, and I'm going to work with him and help make him. And yet Bannon is, he's claimed that the defense budget is an obscenity, that capitalists are welfare queens, that Silicon Valley is full of techno-feudalists who want to turn you into a digital serf. He wants to soak the rich with a tax. He calls the oligarchs disgusting and revolting. You know, so there's like something there to work with. There's something there, I think, that overlaps with the larger project. But the liberal institutionalists have not done their job. It is living off the weaknesses of liberalism. I think the big lie alone, the fact that this was even a viable idea, is suggestive of the ramshackle nature of the electoral system that needs to be nationalized. Finally, does anybody remember Clinton's keynote at the DNC where he said, finally, and everybody clapped? Where do we go? What to do? The sort of operative rule is never ask an historian the future. But I actually walked away from this somewhat, just a little bit, optimistic. Actually, the original manuscript for this is like 150 pages. So here's what I think. I think the center left in the United States is not going to win by tweaking a message, digging into some untapped tranche of suburban voters in Phoenix or Atlanta, or digging up another bland, unoffensive intellectual campaign manager. If democracy is going to be saved, it will have to be with the gut, not the spreadsheet. The fight against the usurpers of the American project, not adjustments to the capital gains tax. By throwing verbal punches with a populist sense of verve and anger, not laundry lists of policies. And this is going to have to balance the troika of democracy, inequality, and diversity. Of these, we have a shaky grasp on diversity, skyrocketing inequality, and very, very bad democracy. Louis Brandeis famously said that you can have inequality or you can have a democracy. You have to choose. I think that's true. But now we have another problem, which is diversity. It's always been there, I suppose, but now we are conscious of it. And to have a multicultural republic that sustains diversity, it cannot be based on the shaky infrastructure of economic inequality. Otherwise, all we're going to get is more populist rage. Thanks.
From the American Academy in Berlin, you're hearing today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas from eminent American historian Jefferson Cowie, and we're delving into the rise of populist rage. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have you with us. Our email address, if you want to share your reflections on anything that you're hearing, that you resonate with, or you don't, bigideas@abc.net.au is our email address. Jefferson Cowie now takes questions from a very informed audience.
I'm Katrin Föckner, and you explained how pretty much up till now, the two-party system absorbed populism, and that now there is a paradigm shift. Can you talk a little bit more about the role of Elon Musk? It seems that now populism is absorbing what until recently would have maybe been an elite that is rejected.
Right. And I think that's a fantastic question. Thank you for that. I think you could add to that the fact that Donald Trump himself is a rich man. We can debate how rich he is, but he certainly tells us he's rich. The one thing that people voted for, most of the people who voted for Donald Trump in 2024 voted for the things that Steve Bannon wanted, not the things that Elon Musk wanted. And I think, and I hope, that Trump is doing himself a disservice by bringing in the broligarchy into such a prominent role in the White House, and the destruction of the administrative state. That is the obvious split coming. And it almost feels like a completely unforced error that Trump is making here. Unless they're willing, and they might be, to completely seize power, I think that is the main vulnerability, that he can no longer claim to speak in any way for the people with Elon Musk in the Oval Office. Why he's there, I don't know. One of the most interesting things about this moment is it's completely uncharted territory. The only thing I can tell you is this is a continuation of the populist trend in American history, that what's unique is that the populist captured the party, that getting out of this will require some kind of populist movement. But this alliance is a mystery.
Hi there, John Kampfner. I wanted to ask you a question. You talk about populism as an ever-present, but it also, in terms of the holding onto and taking of political power, it's cyclical, or it has been, may not be in future, but it has been cyclical in American and in other countries' systems. What is it in each cycle that leads populism to lose its way and, for want of a better term, mainstream politics regains its foothold? Why is it that populism in history sometimes hasn't prevailed?
Right. I think it's the breakdown of the old paradigm that is the kind of churn that allows populism to become a national force. There's this kind of live wire arcing around the political system at that moment, say the 1970s or the 1930s. The job is to bring it in, as I was saying, into the political mainstream. And that can mean anything. For Roosevelt, it meant that he had to pass Social Security because he was getting so much heat from the populace. That kind of positive policy outcome is one of the great positives of populist movements. The negatives are the George Wallaces or what have you. So my hope toward the end there was that there is a sort of pugnaciously oriented progressive voice into which who can talk about things that matter to me, healthcare, housing, jobs, bread and butter issues, but can present it in a way that resonates with this grammar, with this vocabulary. People want to see energy and action more than they want to hear a bunch of wonks. We want to sit around and, you know, talk about where, you know, the best earned income tax credit might be. They don't. Finding that voice, somebody like Ann Richards from Texas, or somebody like from back in the day, or, you know, somebody like, well, consider, for instance, even the presidents that we've had. If you look at the president, the Democrats who won, they all had a sort of hint of populism. Harry Truman, yes. Adlai Stevenson,
nope.
Jack Kennedy, kind of a separate category. Johnson, completely. Hubert Humphrey, absolutely not. Carter, a little bit. Clinton, a little bit. Obama, a little bit. But Kerry, no. Hillary Clinton, no. Kamala Harris, no. And the problem with what I'm saying is the gendered nature of the populist language, and which is one of the reasons I'm a big fan of Ann Richards.
My name is Aaron. I'm a researcher with the Rosa Luxemburg Institute.
Oh.
If I understood you correctly, you were saying that populism often or can arise from a lack of working class movement in this kind of vacuum.
Right.
And so I'm wondering then if that means that a working class movement is a form of like antidote to populism. And I'm also wondering if you want to share any thoughts about Bernie Sanders while we're...
I'm a labor historian by birth and trade. I have been chasing the labor movement for decades, and it has yet to come alive again in the United States. I wrote a book called The Great Exception that essentially says labor had one great breakthrough in its entire career in America, and that was between 1935 and 1937. Other than that, it's been defense. That was such a great breakthrough, such a leap forward, but they've been on the ropes ever since. This is kind of my rearguard effort, in a way. If national solidarity suddenly sprang out and the working class was on the march again, I'd be there. I don't see the potential energy for that. The question of Bernie, I think, is interesting. Bernie kind of talks like a populist, but I actually think he's much more of a technocrat than we think he is.
Because what does he talk about? The capitalists, the work, the oikos. He is a class warrior. He is not a populist, I don't think, in that sort of broader language. I think Elizabeth Warren was actually a little bit more of one. But I think both of them had a lot of potential energy around these issues, unrealized. But I'm a fan of all of their efforts. Bernie comes from a socialist tradition. He's a member of the, you know, more power too. I got no problem with that. I'm not like red baiting Bernie here. But that is different, given what I think I'm onto here. It doesn't quite fit.
Ellen Hensey, Göttingen University. Hi. I have a bit of a provocative question.
Great.
I think that probably this room is over full because the question and the title of your presentation tonight touches us all very deeply. We're all very concerned about this. And I wanted to ask about what I think is sort of a tale of two populisms.
Okay.
One of them is which you wonderfully outlined today, which is about American populism, the history of American populism. You know, if we're talking about it within the borders of America and within the traditions of Wallace and Reagan and that sort of thing, which is about domestic conflicts, domestic politics. Another tale of populism, of course, is what Arendt called the populist phase of authoritarianism.
Right.
And here we have the second question, which is sort of the elephant in the room, where you have populism, which is a phase of, which is basically instrumentalized mobilization for eventual state capture and authoritarianism. And it does seem that the appearance of someone like Musk, because you were asking about sort of the shift between Bannon and Musk, I'm not so sure how big that shift is, is happening at a time of global illiberalism, and perhaps not populism, and something that's unfolding in front of us each day. So I wondered if you could talk about this sort of tale of two populisms.
No, you're probably correct. As I said in my opening remarks, that I think the die is kind of cast in that direction, that they have set themselves up for an authoritarian populist regime, that the center left has failed to come up with any kind of modernizing project to compete with that. So I think we're probably in agreement. The next step I want to go is my response as a political actor is not sort of technocratic neoliberalism better delivered. It's a fighting faith. I did a piece last summer in the New Republic basically saying that even liberalism did best when it exceeded its own boundaries. It stretched its limitations and its own sort of self-imposed logics. And I think that's kind of where I was at with the kind of the voting rights stuff. They're failing themselves in that regard. I'm trying to be upbeat here. But I think I agree with the premise of your question, but I'm not ready to throw in the towel. On an international and comparative basis, there's kind of multiple dimensions of that. What Trump avoided doing last time was invading anything. And I always thought all he had to do was invade somewhere and he got a second term automatically. And he didn't do that. That's not going to happen this time, I don't think. I don't know. There's wiser people in foreign affairs in this room. From a domestic driver perspective, that's my gamble. And what you're seeing is the rise of a certain set of collective, you know, right-wing oligarchic crony capitalist operations across the world. And it looks like the old, allegedly oldest republic in the world is about to join them.
Historian Jefferson Cowie from Vanderbilt University. And he's written a number of books, one of which won the Pulitzer Prize in History, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. Thanks to the American Academy in Berlin for this excellent event. We love taking you across Australia and the world on Big Ideas to hear from big thinkers helping us all make sense of the world. We help you go deeper and beyond the headlines. And you can find all our recent episodes by searching for Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app or find our podcast on all the best podcast apps and recommend us to your friends. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.